What are the standards by which we measure being grown up? Obviously, the measure is not simply one of years. All of us know some very young people who are judicious, disciplined, and we know people well up in their years who are still careless and emotionally juvenile, innocent. Now, obviously, there are many qualities of the mature person. But certainly one of these, and perhaps a major one among these, is the recognition that it is through overcoming difficulty, through frustration, passing through frustration to understanding, through hard work and perseverance, that we grow. The heights by great men reached and kept were not attained by sudden flight. But they, while their companions slept, were toiling upward in the night. What the poet spoke is what the nursery rhyme tells our youngsters. The little train toiling up the hill, I think I can, think I can, I think I can, I think I can. I thought I could, I thought I could. Through sufferings, through overcoming, through discipline, we grow. All of us have hidden dreams. All of us have hopes, high hopes for ourselves. To the juvenile person, life is a great big lottery. Someday his dreams will come true, the ball will drop out of the cage where these balls are spun, his number will be called, and he'll be an instant winner in the game of life. Now, we Jews know that there's a good bit of luck in life. We're always willing to say mazel tov at any occasion. But at the same time, we recognize that beyond luck, there must be hard work and discipline, training, practice, long sleepless nights, weekends not spent on leisure and sport, but in hard work. Do you remember a few years ago, there was a delightful little book about childhood under the rather long title, Where Did You Go? Out. What Did You Do? Nothing. Well, somehow I can't imagine an Isaac Stern answering the questions the same way. You know, where did you go? To the violin. And what did you do? I practiced for 6 hours. It is through that kind of disciplined training, through overcoming the tears of frustration which come to us whenever we try to master a discipline, to become fluent in a language, to become proficient in a profession. It's through such kind of exertion and exercise and suffering that we grow into our talents and develop them and become the kinds of people, develop the kinds of ability which give us the success, if we're lucky, and the sense of being someone that's important to us. Now, as a rabbi, if I were to develop this theme in a sermon, I would, of course, end with a quotation from the rabbis. And since we're talking about Shimon bar Yochai this morning, since he's the hero of the day, let me use a quotation from Shimon bar Yochai as a rabbi would to make this simple point. Someplace in our literature, he's quoted as having made the rather surprising observation, Tovim Yisurin, that the sufferings which come our way are beneficial. They're good for us. And he observed further that it is the three great gifts which God gave to man, to the Jew, the gift of the Torah, the gift of the land of Israel, and the gift of eternal life, are all given to him in such a way that they are inextricably intertwined with suffering, with exertion, with perseverance. The Torah is what? It's a book on a library shelf. Unless we read it and study it and open ourselves up to it and undertake that very difficult discipline of making its high values part of the very fabric of our lives. And the land of Israel, any land, but for us, the land of Israel is what? It's a wasteland unless by the sweat of our brow we unclog the drainage and irrigation ditches, and we see that the stones of the hedgerows are kept in order, and we plant the trees which bind the soil to the earth, and we carefully cultivate the land and build its roads and build its walls and its cities. And in the years in which our people still fondly hope for the ultimate blessing, that of life eternal, they recognized full well that unless they lived a disciplined life here, gave up many things here, lived a life of high quality here, they would not enjoy paradise, heaven, the blessings that await. Now, rabbis have been preaching in this vein, giving good moral instruction week in and week out for the generations. And anyone, I'm not quite sure how much value there has been to all this good instruction, how much has been heard and listened to. It's good for the rabbi to say it, he at least listens to himself. But I do know that in the process, congregations have by and large come to the conclusion that rabbis, those people who are inevitably being quoted, are contemplative men, philosophically minded men, probably bearded sages who spend a good bit of time in a book-lined room poring over ancient texts, seeming to emerge from time to time only to pronounce these immortal quotations which other rabbis can use and provide to you. What I'd like to do in this set of occasional lectures on some of the rabbis is to give you a more rounded image of these men. They are not simply founts of quotations. And in the process of coming to know the kind of religious leaders that our people have had over the ages, I think you'll come to know something more of the very special identity which is part of our, which is thrown up by our religious tradition. For in measure as these men were worldly, and they were worldly, in measure as they wrestled with the realistic problems of the day, and they did, they tell us something about this worldliness and something about the practicality and something about the basic dimensions of Jewish concern. We're concerned more with the here and now than we are with immuring ourselves behind some monastic walls and living through a life of asceticism or liturgy, a life of saintliness, which would prepare us in some way, presumably, for the bliss that awaits. There's a second purpose to this new series, and it's this. That really, for the first time in our history, we are able to present an understanding of what these early rabbis were like, the role that they played, the teachings that was theirs, the position that they had in their communities. Our literature, particularly our rabbinic literature, is massive, but is not arranged critically. Chronology is not a very important factor. Many stories are told about a specific rabbi and told again about another rabbi and yet a third. Many quotations are put in the mouth of one man and of a colleague and somebody of another generation. And most of the statements that come down to us out of the rabbis are what we call gnomic. That is, they're without a perspective. We're not quite sure what they meant in their particular context. Take the example of the phrase that I gave to you from Shimon Bar Yochai, blessed is suffering. It can be used as I used it. It can be used to suggest that it is only by diligently applying ourselves to that which is frustrating and difficult do we master it and come to a new sense of confidence. But if we remember that Shimon Bar Yochai was a sage of the second century, that the great event of the second century was the Bar Kokhba rebellion, that rebellion of the Jews against Rome between the year 132 and 135, if we remember that it was a devastating rebellion, vicious, brutal, that 1 million Jews died in this futile struggle against Rome, if we remember that in the preparation for this rebellion, there were those who said, we've just gone through a bloodbath 50 years ago, the first revolt in which the temple was destroyed. Our land is devastated. All of us have lost family to the Roman army. How can we think of fighting again? It's futile, it's suicidal. If we remember that this is the context, the political context in which Shimon Bar Yochai lived, if we remember that Shimon was one of those who preached rebellion, there's another possible explanation for this sentence. And that is that he was arguing with someone who said to him, look, enough is enough. Enough bloodshed, it's futile. Enough damage to our land, enough persecution, enough Roman oppression. All that a rebellion will do is to have the Roman brute grind us down into finer and finer dust. And he was making the point of only a true believer, that yes, there will be suffering, but that only through enduring such suffering that we can hope to really fulfill the Torah, because Rome is making it difficult for us to obey the commandments, prohibiting us to teach the Torah. It is only through suffering that we will ever have freedom for our own country. And whatever the suffering may be, it will be a test to us. And if we pass that test, then we will merit life in the world to come. But in a sense, Shimon bar Yochai foresaw the pain and the anguish of the revolt and was saying, there is no other choice. We must accept this difficult road. We're beginning more and more, as men of critical historical knowledge are applying themselves to the literature, to understand the context in which this literature is to be placed. And we're also beginning to understand how to separate out the legendary in the lives of these men from what we can know and rediscover about their actual lives. I don't know how many of you were in New York in the last few weeks, but at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, there's been a rather remarkable display of the art of the Mediterranean basin, particularly the Eastern Mediterranean world, between, say, the first century before the Common Era, the fourth and fifth century of our era. And it was called the Age of Spirituality. It's a little known period. It's a period of great faith. The new faiths were coming into their own, Mithraism, Christianity. Judaism for the early centuries until these fatal rebellions was converting a good part of the Roman world. The mystery cults were in their ascendancy. People lived in a world of faith, and they told faithful stories about their religious leaders. This is the time the gestae and the vitae of the lives of the saints, of the lives of the church fathers, of the lives of the early rabbinic leaders. And these legends circulated, they were attached to one man or to another. Legends about their ingenuity, about the miracles associated with their saintliness and so on. And the Talmud and the Midrash are filled with such miracle stories. But Shimon bar Yochai, we're told that after the war against Rome, he went north into the Galilee, and he came to the major city of the Galilee, Tiberias, on the sea. And the Jews who wanted to live in the Galilee had a problem with Tiberias because there were so many bodies buried in the city. It's an old rabbinic principle that was just a new rabbinic principle in its day, that it was a form of uncleanliness to bury corpses within the city walls, and an unclean place was a place that no Jew should live. Tiberias was the capital of this area into which Jews were moving to some numbers. They wanted to live in Tiberias. What was to be done? Well, according to this legend, Shimon bar Yochai had an answer. He had them bring any number of eucalyptus shoots, a fast-growing tree. And he planted them throughout the city wherever there was a suspicion that here was a graveyard, here was a mausoleum. And wherever the tree, according to this legend, took root, he knew that the soil was free beneath. But where the tree couldn't take root, where the roots couldn't claw their way into the ground, he knew that there was stone underneath, a mausoleum, an ossuary, and he had the body exhumed. And in that way, Tiberias became clean, and Jews could live in that city. Now, it's obviously a legend of an ingenious leader, religious leader, who managed somehow to solve a very difficult problem facing a Jewish community. But what's involved in this story? How did it come into being? Obviously, it came into being because of new laws, new rules of cleanliness and uncleanliness associated with the emergence of a rabbi class. Jews had lived in many cities, including Jerusalem, in which there were graves within the city walls. The rabbinate was coming into being, and the rabbinate had reshaped, renewed, redeveloped Judaism, extended it into many areas where it had not made demands before. And these demands impinged upon the ability of the people to thrive, to survive in difficult times. And obviously some adjustments had to be made, and somehow way back then, Shimon Bar Yochai made some adjustment which allowed Jews to live in Tiberias. And when later generations thought about this, they remembered with gratitude whatever it was that he had accomplished, and they told a miracle story, an ingenious story about his skills. Now, this story, however, tells us something about the role of the rabbi. The term rabbi, the term that my title, is one that goes back 1900 years in our tradition. It never appears in the Bible. The word rav appears in later literature, legal literature, to mean the master, the owner of a servant, the owner of a house, the owner of a slave. And it becomes an honorific title in the first century. It becomes an honorific title at exactly the time when something traumatic is happening in the history of our people. That is, the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem during the first Jewish revolt against Rome. And it suggests that a new kind of religious leader has come to the fore, and that Judaism has been reshaped. And what was that new shape that Judaism took with which the rabbis are associated? Well, first of all, though the title remains the same, it's clear that an Akiba or a Hillel or Shimon ben Bar Yochai was a very different kind of person than I am. We bear the same title. We are committed to Jewish survival. We are committed to Jewish learning. But my world is the world of the synagogue. It's the world of the school. And their world was a quite different world. They were not associated with any institution. They were not synagogue people as such. No rabbi in those centuries conducted services, preached a sermon, taught a confirmation class. Their world was much more like the world of the Greek philosophers, who, as you know, when they became masters, went to one city or another, a Plato, an Aristotle, a Zeno, an Epicurus, and they drew to them adults who were interested in wisdom. And by a form of dialogue, of discussion, they would talk with this group of already well-educated men about the nature of what is right and what is true and what is just and what is good, about the nature of wisdom, on the assumption which was common throughout the ancient world that if you knew what was right, you could do the right. If you knew what was just, you would inevitably be able to do that which was just. That the reason that people made mistakes, sinned, was that they were ignorant. They lived in the world of appearances. They didn't see things clearly or truly. The philosopher's mind was cleared up. He cleared up the confusions of other people, and in so doing, he helped them improve their lives. Education 2,000 years ago was not simply, as it is today, mastering a technique, mastering a skill, mastering a body of materials without any assumption that our character is improved in the process. It was then an assumption that by learning, we learn to live more properly. And what was true of the philosophers among the Greeks was true of the rabbis among the Jews. The rabbis sought wisdom. They wanted wisdom because the more wise you were, the more you understood, the better you lived, the more appropriate your life would be to the way God demanded us to live, them to live. But there's a difference. The Greeks were philosophers. They looked at the world and tried to understand the world. The Jews, Jewish leadership, were rabbis. They looked at the Torah, the revelation, and they tried to understand what revelation, in fact, was all about. They looked at Sinai, at the Torah, and they were the great interpreters, the enlargers of the truth implicit in the Torah. Their motto was, Hafach beh vehafach beh dekula beh. Turn it over, and that is the Torah, and turn it over again, for everything is in it. Let me put this matter another way. When the Jews returned from the Babylonian exile in the 6th pre-Christian century, conventional Judaism, the Judaism of most people, rested on two fundamental assumptions. The first is that God had revealed his way to Moses at Mount Sinai. The covenant was stipulated, and by observing the 600 or so commandments in the Torah, a Jew did the right, did what God demanded of him. And moreover, by participating in the cult, in the sacrifices and the singing and the worship and the ceremony of the temple in Jerusalem, he participated in the saving rites and the redemptive rites of his people. The written word, exactly as it was intended, and the attendance at worship, pilgrimage to Jerusalem, these were the basic categories of the faith. But as the Torah came into being and it was published by Ezra and read by to the people, there came to be a group of sensitive men who took Judaism seriously. And they said, God surely intended in the Torah, in his revelation, more than it says literally. What was intended? And they began to interpret, to comment on, to relate ideas that were in the Torah. Originally, these men were called Hasidim, the pious ones. And as they drew out what they believed to be the implications of the biblical text, refined them, they developed a series of rules of diet, of purity, of religious discipline, of moral discipline, far more extensive than any that Judaism had insisted on before. And more, their way of life became somewhat distinct, separate from the life of the ordinary Jew, who attended the temple on the holidays, observed some minimal dietary laws, observed the Sabbath, and listened to the Torah text being read as part of the routine of worship. These separatists, these men who believed that the Torah was obviously a much more profound document, being the Word of God, than it seemed to be on the surface, became more and more distinct in their way of life. They came to be called Perushim, the separatist ones, from which the word Pharisee, so familiar from the New Testament and histories of the time. These are the Pharisees. These are men who believe that the Torah is a body of infinite wisdom, that the Torah text has an infinite number of depths to it. And by interpreting these depths, we can evolve a fully coherent, fully articulated, fully defined Judaism. And those who were able to comment on the text, to articulate and define this new Judaism, were the rabbis. They are those who found the means of interpretation, who argued and discovered and who finally agreed among themselves as to the specific ways in which the Torah text was to be exploded out so that a new dimension of Jewish life was to come, came to the fore. Now, originally, the rabbis and the Pharisees were a minority, a small minority within the larger Jewish community. But with the destruction of the temple in the year 70, one half of the old conventional Judaism disappeared. The people were shocked and traumatized. There was need for a far more ramified, coherent Jewish way of life, something which was distinguishable. Wherever you lived, even if you couldn't go to the temple, there had to be a way to be a Jew, to do the Jewish thing. And the rabbis had, in their presence, offered an example of what it meant to be a Jew and to do the Jewish thing. And more, they became the living exemplars of the religious tradition. And over the centuries, their way of being Jewish ultimately became the way for the whole community of Jews to be Jewish. The Pharisaic minority gave us ultimately the rabbinic tradition, which we now call Orthodox or traditional. Now, the rabbis were distinguished among the Pharisees. They were their leaders, and they were distinguishable. That is to say, their dress was different than the ordinary Jew. Their rules of diet were different. They wouldn't eat certain kinds of food unless they'd been properly prepared and tithed. They were concerned with lustrations and washings and certain kinds of ceremonies. Those who came to study with them watched their courtesy and their manner and their method of living with other people, as well as they listened to their teaching, because obviously they knew. They were the examples of what a Jew must do, might do. And out of that example, obviously, came a new way of life, a reform of the biblical way of life, if you will, an extension of the biblical way of life. And also out of that sense of distinctiveness came a sense of holiness. The average Jew, seeing this learned man to whom others turned for wisdom, seeing this committed Jew who dressed Jewishly, who ate Jewishly, who somehow seemed to be attuned with what God demanded, who was thought of as my master, my teacher, rabbi, the average Jew came more and more to associate holiness with this man and to come to him to be healed, to find out the propitious day for his daughter's wedding, or to open up a new business. He became a holy man in that sense of the word. And there's still a residual sense of holiness associated with the rabbinate. When we have a winter such as this, more than one among you says to me, "Now, why did you do this to me? Can't you do something about it?" As if it's somehow my fault. Now, these holy men, these sages, these masters of the depths of the tradition, wove out of the Bible a very intricate and involved and ramified Jewishness, Judaism, which became the life-sustaining way of life for our people once the temple had been destroyed. It is they who provide the leadership. It is they who provide the example. It is they who pioneer a new way of going about the ancient faith. But they were obviously people who lived very much part of their world. And their world was a convulsed and difficult world. I spoke already of the fact that Shimon Bar Yochai lived at a time of rebellion, and he was part of the group who cried out for rebellion. Here we discussed the debates that he had with some of his colleagues about the wisdom of rebellion. And after one of these debates, he was denounced to the Romans. And he was sentenced in absentia to death. And he heard of the sentence, and he fled with his eldest son, a man named Eliezer. And according to the tradition, they fled and they went to the desert and they lived in a cave for 13 years, just the two of them, living on dates and olives and the pod of what's called in Israel today St. John's Wood, the carob tree. They lived, in other words, minimally, surviving as best they could off of the countryside. And in these 13 years of withdrawal, of living in a cave, of communing, if you will, with God, of communing with the silence, there was associated with Shimon Bar Yochai a new sense of the mysterious, a new sense of illumination. Those who live apart, whose bodies must suffer, who live with God, have associated with them a unique kind of holiness, a mystic translation, an illumination. Their souls rise up and somehow join the Godhead. And in this age of spirituality, which is precisely the age when men were going out into the wilderness and climbing up on pillars and living there for months on end, afflicting their bodies that their souls might rise to God. In this age of piety and of spirituality, all kinds of powers, of mystic powers, were associated with this sage, this rabbi who survived for 13 years in the cave. And if you go to Israel today, and you go to the Galilee, to a place called Merom, you'll see there the burial spot of Shimon Bar Yochai. And ever since his death, sometime late in the second century, Jews have been coming to the grave of this saint and praying there for healing, praying there for success, praying there for whatever it is that they need. It's been a place of pilgrimage for 1,700 years, one of the most important pilgrimage shrines among our people. It doesn't normally associate Jews and pilgrimage, Jews and shrines, but there you are. This man was a man who was vouchsafed the mysteries, according to the tradition, during his 13 years of withdrawal of cave living, and so much so that all manner of books telling of the time when the Messiah would come, revealing the mysteries of the universe, were authored much later in his name, including that greatest of medieval mystical texts, the Zohar. Shimon Bar Yochai was claimed to be, by those who edited the Zohar, the author of its secrets. Now, in point of fact, when he emerged from the cave, he went back to the ways of being this kind of itinerant teacher. He drew to himself some of the leading future scholars of the next generation, and he taught them his understanding of what it is that this new Judaism was all about, how one developed and refined the tradition, what Midrash represents. He did so at a place called Tekoa, which is in the Galilee. It's an unknown place. We can't locate it. Obviously, it was simply his home. There were no colleges in those days, no dormitories. You simply came and lived with the master for as long as you could and learned from the master all that you could. And surprisingly, one of his methods of teaching is a relatively modern one. We call it the Ta'amei HaMitzvot. There are the laws. And there are all those other laws by which scholars and teachers and rabbis had evolved from their understanding of the text, the relationship of words in the text, the relationship of sentences to each other, all the means of commentary. The Ta'amei HaMitzvot implies that there must be a sociological, a psychological, a spiritual reason for each of these commandments. And it was Shimon Bar Yochai's special skill that he could seek out the reason for Sabbath observance, seek out the reason for all the rules, and in understanding the reason, extend by extension, suggest to Jews what it is they must do beyond the letter of the law. And when 100 years ago or so we broke with rabbinic law, we said we can no longer abide by its the fullness of its teachings. We live in a new age. And we understand how valuable it was in its age, but that age has since passed. The leaders of liberal Judaism, leaders of conservative Judaism, went back and tried to understand the Ta'amei HaMitzvot, the reasons for the observance. If the Sabbath is to be observed so that there will be one day in seven, one period in each period of our lives devoted not to the use which we can make of the world, but to our own spiritual development, then somehow if we can build into our lives not only the pattern of some Sabbath observance, but a pattern which allows us to withdraw, to think about other things than success, climbing the greasy pole, making ourselves wealthier or more powerful. If there's a period of time in which we take to ourselves, a time for the refreshment of our own souls through learning, through family, and the like, then somehow we are continuing a tradition without abiding it in each of its many aspects, traditional aspects. And many of the Ta'amei HaMitzvot, many of the understandings of the commandments, which are still valid today, which still have meaning for us today, were first suggested 1,800 years ago by Shimon Bar Yochai. If this rabbi were to come into this synagogue, or to any synagogue, Reform, Conservative, Orthodox today, he would not understand the nature of what we do. His world was not the world of liturgy. It was not the world of worship. That is not to say he didn't worship. It was a world in which the fundamental commitment which a man made was a commitment to learning. And the basis of that commitment was that if I can truly understand, I can truly live. If I know the right, I can do the right. We who have understood Freud and understand that knowledge itself cannot liberate the soul from some of its passions and needs, can no longer accept this simple truth. But this way of perceiving learning was basic to the whole pattern of civilization, Jewish and non-Jewish, in the West for 1,500 years. It's the reason that learning is reverenced among our people. It's not that the Jew could master a body of information and stick a pin through the Talmud and know every word that appeared, you know, on each page where the pin pierced through. That was a kind of intellectual game. Learning was valued by the Jew because learning made you a better human being, a better Jew. The more you knew, the better you would be. It seemed inevitable. And obviously the rabbinate established a great deal of its suasive authority among Jews because there was a relationship between learning and the quality of one's life. It was not absolute, but there was a relationship. Now the relationship, I suspect, did not come from learning per se, but that those who were concerned with the learning enterprise were by their very nature people who were willing not to devote every minute of their lives to making more money, who were willing not to devote every minute of their lives to the game of power or the game of success, who would take time out for this kind of undertaking, and by that very nature suggesting that they were a special breed, a special kind of person. And there is much in the lives of these rabbis, much in the few stories which come down to us about their lives, which seem to have verisimilitudes, that seem to be true, which suggests that there was a special quality, special humanity, if you will, to them. There's one lovely story told about Shimon Bar Yochai. In the old Jewish tradition, if a marriage was childless after 10 years, there was usually a divorce, so that there could be, through a remarriage, the opportunity of having children. A couple came to Shimon Bar Yochai. They'd been married for 10 years. They were very much in love. And they said, "We've decided that we need a divorce so that my husband's line can continue, there can be children." And Shimon Bar Yochai noticed that they were very much in love. He was unhappy that they would go through this process, though he understood the conventional, the cultural pressures that were imposed on them. And so very much in a way that a good rabbi might operate today if such a problem were presented to him, he prayed that it would not happen as they spoke. And he suggested to them out loud, "Well, why don't you do it this way? Just as you had a great wedding feast before your marriage began, make a feast now for the end of your marriage. And bring some of the feelings, the poetry, the love songs into that feast that were sung when you began 10 years ago." And so they did. And the love songs were sung, and the poems which had been read at the marriage were read again. They had no photographs in those days, and no tape recorder to trot out the ceremony as it had been held. But somehow, as all these memories came flooding back to this couple, they decided not to go through the divorce. And he had saved a marriage, even as many of us in the rabbinate today would like to save more marriages than we, in fact, are able to do. Shimon Bar Yochai was an interesting man. He was a difficult man. He seemed to have a good deal of arrogance to him. But he was a rabbi of the original breed, a man who was devoted to the enlargement of the web of Jewish life. All truth was in Torah, it was God's word. Let's find the way of exposing that truth to man. And I would not suggest to you that in this period of our history, when a third great transformation is taking place among our people, that the way that these early rabbis went is the way that we can go. But just as they discovered a means of making Judaism more coherent, more distinctive, of giving it the survival characteristics that were required in their day, so we, as best we can, must find the ways of making Judaism distinctive and giving it survival characteristics in our own. And to Shimon Bar Yochai, there were three central concerns: the Torah, the text, the long stream of tradition, the land, the people, the land of Israel, the independence of that land, and the quality of one's life, the quality which would redeem life. He put it in terms of gaining paradise. We would put it in terms of the redemption of our lives in the here and now. But these truths certainly remain our truths, and these concerns remain our concerns. And somehow, if we can, in our own way, develop that sense of special purpose, of special identity, which he felt and helped to give to his generation, then surely we will have come a long way towards finding the survival mechanisms and the glory and the purpose, the identity of which we must have to sustain the Jewish people and our faith in our own day. Amen.